This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. At the bottom of the hour, I'm going to be talking to Lauren Kate, the author of Orphan Song. But right now, I want to turn to an author who just, tickled me pink, because her first chapter is about my very, very favorite author, and I am so happy to welcome to the program Abby Waxman. Hi, Abby.
Hello, Patsy. How are you?
Okay. Well, the name of the book, your book, is called The Bookish Life of Nina Hill. And I just want to tell you that I was obsessed with Jane Austen when I was 11 years old. Mm-hmm. I read everything over and over for the next 10 years. And when I was 21 years old, I moved to England and bought a 400-year-old cottage near her home, her childhood home.
Oh, how wonderful.
So you can see that when I got this book and I read this chapter, I got such a kick out of it. I thought, of course, I love, being a book nerd myself. I love any book that's set in a bookstore. So just congratulations on this wonderful, wonderful book.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad you enjoyed it.
Wow, where do we start? This is the premise is so intriguing, and the story is just delightful. Your writing is excellent. I could just sit here, talking and praising you for a whole hour. So,
oh my goodness!
Oh yes, so you can blush because you have really created a book that I know so many people will enjoy, and of course, so many of the book nerds in the world will relate to. And it's also a book about millennials. So, tell us about it.
So yeah, it is about millennials. So Nina is a young woman. She's maybe 27. She works in a bookstore, and she has her life pretty much exactly as she wants it. She has it. Pretty competitive trivia team. She has a different book club every week. She has her job. She has her planner. She has her cat. And everything is just tickety-boo. And then the father that she never knew dies and leaves her not only a mystery gift, but also a vast selection of new relatives, many of whom are very friendly and some of whom are not. So, yeah, everything sort of falls apart, and it's how she deals with a suddenly, rapidly expanding world.
Wow, it is, and from one story, one chapter after another, it just builds on. And as you, I always hate to tell people what's going to happen, but because I just found it so fascinating, I didn't know where it was going to go, and so I just sort of rolled with the punches and just enjoyed one thing after another. And I didn't know sort of in advance some of the things that were going to happen. So I found it a really great read.
I'm so glad. Yeah, it's very lighthearted. It is not a particularly serious book, but hopefully it is entertaining. That's the long.
Well, it's entertaining, but it's also, it also has some depth, there's depth in there because you are talking about a subject, Nina is living a sort of very isolated life in many ways, and in fact, so many millennials are. But you've created for her, and she's created for herself a family of sorts, which I think again is something that's happening. So I think this is something that millennials can really relate to.
I hope so. I'm very fond of millennials. I think they get a lot of. They get a lot of flack for things that are not in any way their fault. And my experience of them is that they're, very well read, and they watch a lot of movies, and they talk a lot about culture and media. And I find them all very charming.
Well, that's good. My son is a millennial. He's up at the University of Wisconsin. And when I was up there, I too met people very much like Nina, because I it's a university town, so they have small bookstores, real bookstores.
Yeah.
And the joy of walking into a real bookstore, where the owners and the people who work in the store love the books, they know the books, and they arrange them, you know, in ways to entice you to pick up a book. And it was that same feeling in those bookstores up there in Madison, Wisconsin, that I got in your town of Larchmont in California.
Yeah, I really, really love bookstores. And Nina was inspired by all the young women I met who work in the bookstores where I was promoting my last book. And they were all they were smart, they were witty, they were a little bit weird, you know, and a little bit introverted. And I just sort of fell in love with all of them, and I wanted to make them the heroine of the book.
Well,
I love bookstores and book people.
Yes, it works so nicely. And it is true. People, like, sometimes don't understand. Millennials have this yearning to share with each other. That's why, you know, they'll get books and they'll be talking and they'll sit around over a cup of coffee. And also my son plays trivia. He also is in this, a trivia group, I think is a fantastic thing.
Yeah, it's a great thing, and it's a very big thing here. And yeah, I think, like I said, I think millennials are actually an awesome generation, and I, as a Generation Xer myself, I have a lot of sympathy for them and how much they don't really have any privacy anymore. I feel quite bad for them, but they are almost uniformly interested in books and movies and TV and talking about these things and about culture in lots of different ways. So it's always good conversationalist.
Well, tell us about your love of books, because obviously that comes through too.
Yeah, no, I'm obviously a big book nerd also. And like Nina, I have a pretty eclectic taste. Like, I love to read detective books. I love to read regular novels. I love to read old novels. I love movies and everything. Yeah, no, I love to consume stories, wherever they come from.
Now, I just want to play a little bit of the Audible version of this book so people can get a taste of it, okay? Just listen for a minute.
Okay.
You've heard it, but it's wonderful.
You're a bird. You can be any kind of bird, but those of you who've chosen ostrich or chicken are going to struggle to keep up. Now, imagine you're coasting through the skies above Los Angeles, coughing occasionally in the smog. Shiny ribbons of traffic spangle below you, and in the distance you see an impossibly verdant patch, like a green darn in a gray sock. As you get closer, the patch resolves into a crosshatching of old houses and streets, and you have reached Larchmont. Congratulations. You've discovered a secret not even all Angelenos know. It's a neighborhood like any other, but it boasts a forest of trees planted generously along semi-winding streets that look like they were lifted wholesale from a Capra movie and were actually all planted at once in the 1920s. The houses are big but not showy, set back with front gardens that make the streets seem even wider than they are. Even today, most of the houses look the way they always have, thanks to historical preservation and a general consensus that the whole thing is hella cute.
Okay, well, it is a beautiful reading. Your narrator is fantastic. Her name is Emily Rankin, and she captures your book so beautifully. And it is something interesting. More and more people are, you know, listening to books, and
yeah.
I don't know how you feel about it. I'm of course, being a book nerd, I'd love to have the book in my hand, but I do appreciate more Audible books.
Yeah, I am not at the moment a huge audiobook listener, just because I still have sort of multiple small, you know, smallish teenage children in the house. So any moment I can get where no one is talking to me in my ear, the better. So I tend to creep away and curl up with a paper book or with the Kindle. But my husband and my sister both, you know, basically only listen to books now. And when I was listening to different readers for the Audible version, Emily's voice really stood out to me, and I think she did an amazing, amazing job.
She did, and it's funny. Quite a few millennials are reading, are listening to the book, and then, like my son listened to Margaret George's book, Nero book, which came out a while back. He listened to the Audible version, and because I had interviewed her, and he thought it was intriguing, but he's a PhD, you know, student, and he doesn't have much time, and so he listened to it while he was traveling back and forth. And then right. after that, he said, you know, now that I've listened to it, I need the book. Because I want to see the word, I want to see the names, I want to see the flow of the words, and so I think they're not. It's not one or it's not that people will just buy one version. I think more and more people are buying both versions.
Yes, and I think I've certainly seen my husband switch from the the printed page, and then he'll also get the Audible version, and he'll switch between one or the other so that he can keep going with the book while he's driving to work or what, and then when he gets home, he can pick up the paper one. Maybe it is the millennials also leading us in their vast gift for multitasking, so that you can drive and listen at the same time, and walk around and listen. So.
Yes, it is, and when a voice, you have a particularly great narrator like that who reads it so compellingly, your words shine out in the reading. You are so descriptive. It is absolutely beautiful the way you are able to describe things and put us in whether it's you're writing about an oak tree and it's everything is just so beautifully done.
Oh, that's very nice of you. Thank you so much. It's lovely to hear.
Well, so tell us a little bit more what you want to talk about this story. As you said, you developed Abby partly from the young women you met in the bookstores. Mm-hmm. And tell us about some of the other characters. I found Liz fascinating, and of course, this is a romance. There's a romance, and Tom, a very interesting character.
Thank you. Liz is actually based on, so there is a bookstore on Larchmont called Chevaliers, and in the book it's called Knights, which is the world's thinnest disguise, and the woman who runs that bookstore is called Liz, and so this is a direct thank you to her, because she has been extremely supportive, as many independent booksellers are of writers. Like, it's really a team effort to get a book out to people and to encourage people to read it. So I definitely wanted to pay tribute to her. And Tom is the captain of a rival trivia team, who at first Nina thinks is just a jock, someone who's only good at answering sport questions, which of course is an anathema to her, but who turns out to be far more complicated than that. But it's not really a romance book. There is this romantic element, but I never like to write characters who are saved by romance or, who need a man to fix their lives, because that's boring.
Oh well,
she doesn't need to be rescued. But she does like him.
And it's for a summer read. I think it fits the bill. It's the kind of thing it's just a fun read, and that's I think that makes it something that people will remember. And I know that you're in all of your books you are develop characters that are memorable, that are people will read your books and they say, oh well, I feel like I know that person, I could sit down with that person and talk to that person, which is
that's lovely. Yes, I do like to make characters who are recognizable.
Now, why did you, as you said, for Nina, she has some, besides the fact that she, had a strange childhood, she also suffers from panic attacks and. Explain why you included that, and why that is important to the character.
I think I wanted to talk about anxiety with this book, because I think it's something that increasingly people are being honest about experiencing. I think many of us, if not all of us, have certainly experienced anxiety at different times in our lives. And then there are people who struggle with it on a regular basis. And Nina is one of those people. Like, she really is very comfortable in her own space. She's very comfortable in the life that she has created for herself. But when she has to step out of those boundaries, she feels anxious and she finds people quite tiring. So she's very much an introvert, which is also something that matters to me. I think that people have this idea that introverts are failed extroverts, and they're not. So it's a very different thing. And introverts, although they're quiet, are just as complicated and nuanced as anyone else. And so I wanted to talk about how she deals with her anxiety, how she sort of celebrates her own introversion, and how, in the end, she gets on with her life and she doesn't have to change the way she is. She remains true to herself while expanding her circle a bit to include this new family and potentially this new boyfriend. But she remains very true to herself, and, you know, she just deals. She gets on and deals with her anxiety, and she deals with her introversion, and she does fine.
Well, one of the quotes that you have at the beginning of the book intrigued me. It's by Hermann Hesse, and it says, "Solitude is independence." Now, we don't think of millennials as having much solitude.
No, and in fact, I think that's possibly why I feel a lot of sympathy for them. Like, they don't have a lot of solitude. They don't have a lot of quiet. You know, they're sort of reachable. I mean, we all are, but I think that generation grew up just sort of bombarded by culture in every sense, like bombarded by voices and ideas, and sometimes that's great and sometimes it's completely overwhelming. And I think that you know, the desire to crawl into your own space and read or draw or think or whatever in peace is something that they have to really struggle to get for themselves. And so, you know, Nina's had to create this perfect little environment for herself, and sometimes she's a little bit scared to come out of it. But solitude is a wonderful thing.
Well, because today, in this day and age, we're bombarded 24/7 with information, yes. A lot of it we don't want. And I was recently thinking about the fact that there was a time when I was out in the middle of nowhere for quite a while, and I didn't know Elvis Presley died. It's just these things, and it's also when I lived in England, I had much more solitude. I lived in a little village, and there was only the sweet shop and the butcher, and you could walk around the village, and it was there was no news. You knew nothing what's going on in the world,
and you were fine.
I was fine, and I mean, that's why I it was so funny when I was there and I lived there, and I felt, as I'm walking through the fields, I'm walking along the Thames, this could have been a Jane Austen world for all I knew, because I didn't pay attention to the news. I didn't pay attention to anything, you know, other than the trees, the water, the grass. So it's something that we really need, I think.
I agree. I couldn't agree more. And I think that being bombarded 24/7 with information that is not actually relevant to our daily lives also disconnects us from our daily lives, right? So we have to, you know, if we're having to worry about what's going on globally, not that we shouldn't care, we should care, but it's just overwhelming at times. And I think, you know, the need to sort of recenter yourself all the time in peace and quiet is getting lost. You know, it's great to know lots of things. It's great to be exposed to many, many cultures. It's great to be exposed to, you know, stories from all over the world and all the rest of it. But there is a definite human need for rest that I feel we're sort of losing out on.
Well, I think you've done a great job with this book. And I wanted to mention your website, because I think what you have on the website for book clubs is very interesting, and not many authors are doing this. So tell us about your website and why you put up this section about for book clubs.
Yes, so actually the publishers get the credit for this, because they create a book club guide for all my books and for many of the books that they publish, if not all of them. And so I've included all of those on my website, and people can download them. And so there's materials for discussion. There's ideas and synopses of the stories, and book clubs, I hope, will take full use of them. And then I also belong to an organization called Novel Network, which you can find online, novelnetwork.com, where book clubs can be connected with authors who can then come and visit their book clubs, either on Skype or in person if they're closed, et cetera, et cetera. Because book clubs are really super important for writers, because not only do people get together and talk about your book and buy your book, but they give you a lot of feedback and thought about your work that is often very helpful as you move forward to create something new. So, yeah, I love book clubs, and other bookish people in general are so helpful.
Well, I belong to a couple of book clubs, and one particular, the library club, I was thinking that it would be lots of fun. I'm going to suggest that in the fall, when everybody comes back, that we pick up the bookish life of Nina Hill, because it is exactly the kind of thing so many of the members there are interested in books and bookstores and, of course, libraries. So perhaps I could arrange and you could Skype with us one evening.
For sure. It would
be lots of fun for
my pleasure.
For everybody to hear from you. And, you know, authors work so hard, and that's one of the reasons I want to, you know, I love to do this program is I love to promote authors. I love to help them reach new audiences, and to, like, when I do a speech, I go to different book events. I like to talk about authors and that I recommend to people to read, because I think, like, for example, The Bookish Life of Nina Hill is just, it's very innovative. I thought the idea of the concept of was something new and fresh. Your writing is really great. From the point of view you captured, I think you captured very much, since I have a millennial son, I thought you captured the millennials perfectly.
Oh, thank you. I hope they think so.
Well,
I'm sure they'll tell me.
My son comes home, I'm going to have him read the book, because I just for the trivia part, he anything to do with trivia. I, as a matter of fact, I collect small books for him with, you know, so that he can be the champion, the champion team in medicine of trivia, because it's fun. These kids need. They need this connection to each other and to sort of a wider group of people, because so many of them, you know, just live far away. You know, this day and age, everybody lives so far away from everybody, from their families. So I think to have this family of friends is very important. And I think you make it very clear in this story that it. You know, it's a wonderful thing for Nina to have this group of people around her.
Right. She's made her own family. And then when she discovers she has this vast actual family, you know, we'll have to see whether she's able to bring the two together or not. But
exactly. So, well, that's pretty well. That's part of the intrigue of the book. And I think everyone will enjoy it. And the name of the book, again, is The Bookish Life of Nina Hill. The author is Abby Waxman, and it's Abby with a ABBI. And
yes,
it's very nice. It's easy to remember. And your website is abbywaxman.com. So
it is.
So it's real easy to find you. It's all of your books are great. I wanted also to say that once they finish this book, they should go and read The Garden of Small Beginnings, which is also a great book. And I wanted to ask you, do you have a visualization corner like Nina?
No, I don't. I have a corner that I go and sit in quietly. But no, I don't have a visualization corner, although I always thought it would be a wonderful thing to have.
Oh, I thought perhaps you had one where you have this visualization, bestseller, bestseller, bestseller. Oh, this book is being made into a movie. This book is being made into a movie. I think you should do a visualization corner.
Yes, I shall make one.
I think you should. You definitely should. Because you are making things happen for yourself.
Thank you.
Really done a great job with all of your books, and you are a fantastic talent. And I know that you have received so many compliments from so many people, including Oprah from Oprah Magazine and all of the others. And I'm just really thrilled that you were on Joy on Paper today, Abby Waxman.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Okay, and have a wonderful another book tour for this one.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, I will.
Bye-bye. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Wow, she's nice. And we're going to have a commercial break and come back, and we're going to be talking to Lauren Kate Orphan Song. Okay.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I am back, and now I'm going to be talking to Lauren Kate, who is the author of The Orphan Song, number one New York Times bestselling author.
Oh, it's such a joy to welcome to Joy on Paper, Lauren Kate, the New York Times bestselling author of many young adult books, including the famous Fallen, which was made into a major motion picture. And today we're going to be talking about her debut adult novel, The Orphan Song. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, this is exciting. I want to play a little song for you first, okay, before we start talking. You'd appreciate that.
Thank you. That set the mood so well. That's exactly the kind of song that my characters would have been singing.
Yes, and that's why I wanted to play, because some, you know, people who have never been to Venice or who don't know Vivaldi might not know that there were so Venice was full of music, as always, but that there were women singers. And this is the story that you've written about, and it's absolutely fascinating.
Thank you. These orphan girls who became trained to sing and perform music for the church became amazingly, like, the most famous musicians in the world in this era. People traveled from all over to see the orphans of Venice sing.
Well, as I said, you know, if you've never, people who have never been to Venice might not be aware of this wonderful, wonderful period of time that you're writing about, this in the 1700s, when Venice was at the height of its glory. So it's fascinating. How did you begin this story? When you were on tour, is that right? When you went to Venice? So you were on a book tour for Fallen, was that?
Yes. I was on a book tour for one of the Fallen novels, and coming home from an event one evening, I got lost on the way back. As if you've ever been to Venice, you kind of cannot avoid getting lost. You have to just sort of surrender to the winding streets. And I found myself standing before this big stone complex called the Hospital of the Incurables, and the names of all the streets around it were named in honor of it, you know, the Alley of the Incurables and the Bridge of the Incurables. And I just started thinking about how haunting and beautiful that name was. I wanted to know who the Incurables were. I did a little bit of research on the building, and I found this amazing history within it, that it was the world's original music conservatory. And not only did it train the foundling girls who lived there to sing and play music, but they attracted the best composers of the era. I mean, Vivaldi, he didn't teach at the Incurables, but he taught at their kind of rival orphanage across the canal. And they were just producing some of the finest Baroque music that was ever produced. And, you know, and Venice was the center of all of it, and these girls were the stars.
Well, having raised a violinist, I'm, you know, very familiar with all of that music of that period, because, it, as you say, it was just an amazing period in musical history. And it is not known widely that the, you know, this was an opportunity for girls to you know, really do something completely different, you know, from anybody else. And it's really fascinating, the level of, you know, how they could rise in this profession of singing.
Yeah, I mean, and particularly children who came from nothing and nowhere, you know, that didn't know their families and had no wealth, that they could really rise to prominence. And what's interesting and kind of heartbreaking about it is that as these girls made the choir and were selected to become performers, not just students, they also had to sign an oath that essentially was signing their lives away to the church. They were restricted from really ever leaving the building unchaperoned. I think they got about 4 outings a year just to go and play music somewhere else, but always, you know, with the church, with the maestros, with their the women who led them around and were in charge of them. They also signed an oath that they could never sing or play music outside of the church. If they, you know, some of them went on to get married or something like that, but if they ever left the orphanage, if they ever left the church, they had to shut down their musical playing and singing forever. And so, of course, with those kind of restrictions, immediately my mind as the writer is going to, which girl can't stand them? Which girl has to rebel? Which girl's going to break free and carve out a different path for herself? And that's where I found the heroine of this story, Violetta.
And, you know, one of the things that, of course, you had to do a deep dive into history here, because Venice has had a very unique, being an island and being separated from everybody else. They really had a very unique lifestyle.
Yes, quite different, and quite different from any of their neighbors. They were really very separate, and they kind of never fit in with the rest of Europe. They were somewhere between the East and the West. They have a lot of ties. Of course, they have ties to the Catholic Church and to the Vatican, but they had almost as many ties to the Ottoman Empire, and you know, you can see that in their architecture, and you can see that in the style of the people and the style of the food, and everything is heavily influenced both by the East and the West. So there, it's always been a kind of liminal city that then eventually became the center of the world for centuries. They were the trading focus, and they were where everything came in and out of. By the time my story is set, their influence in the world and their wealth is actually waning. but they don't want to acknowledge that. They don't want to act like they're losing their grip on power. So what that led to is this era of extreme excess. I mean, people were spending just lavishly to have these elaborate masquerades and balls and parties that went on for months at a time. It was a very strange, decadent, hedonistic moment in history, just before the empire fell, actually.
Well, you know, for anyone who goes to Venice, you see the masks, they're on sale. Until I read your book, I had no idea that people were wearing these masks all the time. I mean, just during the day while they're doing grocery shopping. I was so surprised by this.
Me too. That was when I found that out at the beginning of my research. I thought, I'm in for something really wild with this book because, yes, of course, I've seen the Venetian masks. I had bought them as a tourist in Venice and imagined the parties that they might have been worn at. But no, they wore them to buy fish at the market. They wore them to go and visit a friend. They wore them to listen to a concert, you know, go to the opera. They wore them for everything, even to work. And so, you know, just think about what that does to identity and one's sense of oneself when you can. Everyone is that anonymous. Walking down the street, you might not even know your spouse.
Also,
the masks cover the entire face. It wasn't just the domino mask that covers the eyes that we see now. It was a full face mask that you really could not see behind.
And they're called what?
Bauta.
And they had, of course, different styles. And even now when you go, you see ones with big noses and you see different styles. But and some of the styles really meant something. But it's hard to I'm trying to think of what their minds were like that they would go around all day with these masks on.
You know, it sounds really foreign, doesn't it? But it also reminds me a lot of the masks that we wear today with social media. There's a presentation of self that might be anonymous and might be really different from what's actually happening, you know, in your heart or your thoughts within. The way that we present ourselves, we're always all kind of operating under a mask. And so this is just a very literal one. It led to some really interesting anecdotes in my research. I would, you know, be reading about, a couple who would go. The other thing is you didn't go to parties in this era. You didn't go to the opera or anywhere out of society with your spouse. You did that with a mistress or a boyfriend. It was considered very uncool to be seen out in society with your spouse. But there's one particular anecdote I loved about a man and a woman who were drawn to each other across a crowded party and began to flirt and dance and spent the whole night together. And at the end of the night, the husband lifts the woman's mask. I mean, the man lifts the woman's mask just a little bit to kiss her and realizes it's his spouse. And they were both horrified and embarrassed because that wasn't supposed to happen.
Well, it was certainly you found a strange world, and then you come out with this wonderful character, Violetta. We meet her at the age of 5, and you're telling the story in two different voices. First, Violetta, and tell us a little bit about how you developed her, because she is a very you really created a fascinating character in her.
Yeah, she's a very fierce and independent person, and she, like, you know, most of her peers, is haunted in some way by the mystery of her origin. But the way that she deals with that is by really rejecting ideas of family. She doesn't want to make close bonds with her caretakers. She's quite independent. She dreams of a life where she could start fresh and no one would know she was an orphan. No one would know she had been so undesirable to her family. This is a real, it's a real chip on her shoulder that she wishes she could make vanish.
Was it true that they did a tattoo on the children's foot?
They did. They branded their heels with the letter of the orphanage. So she would have had an eye branded on her heel that marked her.
So it was a brand, like a brand with a branding iron kind of thing?
Yeah.
Oi.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and so for her, I think that it was supposed to be considered like a mark of security, so that the children, you know, if they ever got lost, not that they would ever be able to escape the compound, but if they ever did, they could be returned. They could be, you know, they would know where they came from. But for Violetta, it's a great mark of shame because she feels it means she belongs nowhere. Yeah, and then she meets and falls in love with a boy named Mino, who has a very opposite experience. He's also an orphan, but he was abandoned. He was surrendered to the church much later. He was almost 5 years old, and so he has memories of his mother, and he has an idea of who she is, and he has an obsession with the fact that he doesn't think she meant to leave him, that there was something, some mystery, some darkness that forced her to abandon him. And he believes that if he could only find her and reunite with her, that they could put all of this behind them, that this is some kind of big cosmic mistake. So these two characters, though they're very drawn to each other, they want completely different things out of their lives, and they don't. It's hard for them to understand the other's point of view. So the story is told in alternating points of view, one chapter from Violetta's, then one chapter from Mina's. And I found that as I wrote it, the chapter length got shorter and shorter and shorter because the story was just in a hurry to get the two of them back together again, and to find the one chapter where they could finally reunite.
Okay, well, you know, as I was reading, and I did notice that the chapters got shorter, and I think that it really builds up the tension. Because we want...
Yeah, there's something quite musical about a tempo change in a book that I wasn't anticipating it, but it's just the way the characters wanted their story to be told.
Now, are you a musical... Do you have a musical background? Because you handle the musical sections. As I said, I have two sons who both are, you know, musical, and so I wasn't musical myself as, you know, a child, but... Living with musicians, you really learn a lot about all of these terms and that you use in the book. So, what was your background?
Absolutely, no, I was not a musician either, but I was a dancer. So I trained as a ballet dancer from about the age of four, and so music and the shape that it gives to, I guess, the way I move through the world. My life and my bearing, I think, is quite influenced by music. And I married a musician, and both my children, I mean, they're young, but they're both extremely interested in music. So it is definitely a part of our daily experience. For this, writing this book, I did interview many musicians, and I also took a few violin lessons myself just to kind of get a feel for it. But I think, you know, music is such a transcending force. And so if you are steeped in music in any way, it shows up in every aspect of your life, from the way you talk to the way you think to the way you perceive the world. It's musical.
Well, isn't it wonderful how, you know, being an author is so much fun? Because, I mean... There you were writing young adult fiction very successfully, you know, New York Times best-selling author, and of course Fallen was picked up to be turned into a film, and your young adult books have been translated into, I think, 30 languages, but something as simple as a book tour just really changed, you know, added so much to your life.
Yeah, I mean, inspiration is everywhere, and I think a big part of finding it for me is not pushing it away when it comes, not thinking anything is too inconsequential, knowing that there might be a story in everything. And then, you know, the real joy is, like, spending the next year or so of my life trying on a different life and sinking into a different place and a different kind of person and different obsessions. You know, the way that you experience... Any novel that you really love to read is the way that I experienced my writing process as well.
So once you were in Venice, you get this idea, and it starts sort of forming in you. There was a lot of research. Did you have to go back to Venice to do some more research?
I did. I think the idea kind of sat with me for about a year, and then I was ready to you know, turn my attention to it. So I did go back to Venice. I spent 10 days there doing the research, meeting with historians, visiting each one of these orphanages / conservatories. I went almost every night to one of the churches where these girls performed and listened to Baroque music being played. I mean, they still play Vivaldi. They play the Four Seasons somewhere in Venice nearly every night. So I saw that concerto performed, I think, four different times at four different churches. And just, you know, it was like a time machine. It was like trying to go back and really live the way that these characters would have lived. And I spent a lot of time in the mask making stores and in the with a luthier there who makes violins. It's possible to go back, I think, in Venice. The city really wears its history on its sleeve.
Well, it's one of the joys, really, of writing is that you can get into different people will open the door and welcome you and talk to you that, you know, you never expected, you know, to meet.
Yes. Yes, it's wonderful. And I remember meeting with this one, sort of the foremost Venetian historian there, and she was very concerned for me because she said, you know, there are these four, in this era, there were four ospedali, four of these orphanages where they trained the girls. And three of them are very well preserved. They have all the archives. They still have the vestments that the girls wore. They have the instruments that they played. They have lists of the, you know, grocery orders that they made for what they needed to eat for the week. And the one that I wanted to write about, the incurables, there was nothing. It just, for whatever reason, had not been so well preserved. And this historian kept saying to me, you know, I'm worried we don't have the answer to this. You're asking this and this and this, and I can't give you the answer. And I thought, as a novelist, it was just perfect that there was this hole in the history.
You could read
everything that there was about the other three orphanages and form my idea. You know, find the commonalities and picture what it would have been like at this place. But there was also all this space for me to invent.
Well, it is so much fun. I know I did a script for Apollo astronaut Walt Cunningham's book, and I mean, they opened up the Space Center for me. I'm like, whoa! I get all this behind the scenes, and I got to meet astronauts, and writing can be so. You know, there's the research part can be so much fun. And sometimes people don't realize that. It's, you know, they're thinking, I'm just going to be writing. But I love the research part.
I agree. I mean, even holding up in a library with a stack of books is fun for me. But the real life stuff where you get to get out there and interview people and just the crazy things that you hear, you know, that I would never have known about playing a violin, that you really have to hear it. If you're going to buy a violin, you have to hear it in the space where it's going to be performed, because it's going to sound different in a big cavernous symphony hall than it is in a small room where you're playing a concerto. You know, I that's not something I would have known. And so listening to a violinist who plays at the LA Philharmonic, she took me into all these different rooms and said, let's see how the same song sounds this year. Let's see how it sounds when the windows open. That was just, you know, it's very cool.
It is. And, well, I think you've done a brilliant job with this book. I love books that take me to new places, or, you know, places that in time that I wasn't aware of. And as I said, because I knew generally, you know, having been to Venice, I know the buildings, and I as you said, you get lost. I don't know how many times I got lost in Venice, but and it's wonderful to get lost, because you never know who you're going to meet or where you're going to go, and that's part of the excitement of it. But you really take us back to this era, and I found it fascinating, all of the facts that you bring in, and of course you do it so beautifully. I was really impressed with your writing, and you know, this is a real talent when you can take characters and bring them to life and really make us feel like we're back there in that time. This is a real talent.
Thank you so much. That means a lot to me to hear you say that so articulately, and especially coming from the mother of musicians.
Well, you know, I know that you know, now that you've done the first adult fiction, did you you find it any more difficult to write adult fiction, or it's the same, right?
In some ways, it's the same. I mean, you're still trying to tell a story that's true to the characters, and you're still trying to give the reader a glimpse into a whole human heart and human longing and desire and suffering and all of that. I did find the research for this one a bit more strenuous. I wanted to get it as, you know, accurate as I could and paint as vivid a picture as I could. But I also found it really addictive. So my next work is also adult historical fiction. Now I'm writing about the American Civil War and three prostitutes who worked on the front lines of it who get embroiled in a mystery they have to solve.
Ah, okay. That sounds intriguing. Okay. Well, you know, I want to, again, thank you so much. Lauren Kate, and the name of the book is The Orphan Song, and it's available wherever books are sold. And Lauren, what is your website?
It is laurenkatebooks.net.
That's simple. Kate, K-A-T-E. And,
right.
You know, it's just... it's been a joy for me to talk to you, and a joy for me to be able to... just sort of revel back into this music. I'm listening again to many of the female choirs because I had forgotten how, you know, I hadn't played them for several years. And these are available on YouTube, and it really does, as you're reading the book, I put some of them on, and it is wonderful to hear them.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, Vivaldi's Sacred Concertos is what you played at the beginning and what I've been listening to kind of nonstop for the past year or two. Beautiful.
Yeah, it is. It is fantastic. And for anyone who's thinking of a trip, Venice is a great destination, right?
I agree.
Okay. Well, I look forward to having you back next time when you release your story about the three prostitutes and the Civil War. Okay, solving mysteries. Okay, that sounds really intriguing too. So again, Lauren Kate, thank you so much for joining me today on Joy on Paper.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Bye bye now.
Well, okay, just wanted to remind everyone what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to to see your words on paper, and Lauren certainly has discovered that. Everybody, thank you so much. It was just wonderful to talk to these two great authors, and make sure that you say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, and everybody have a wonderful day. Bye-bye now.